This is Line One, Your Health Connection, a weekly program produced at the studios of KSKA. Each week, KSKA's host, Dr. Thad Woodard, puts you in touch with local and national experts in a variety of health and family issues. Opinions expressed are those of the host, guest, and callers, and do not represent those of KSKA, the licensee, or the underwriters. Here's your host, Dr. Thad Woodard.
Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard, your host, and I'll introduce my guests shortly. First, I'd like to make sure everybody's aware that April is National Child Abuse Awareness Month, and for that very reason, today is the second of a two-part series on child abuse. Today, we're going to be talking a little bit maybe more about evidence and science and what's happening and what do we know and how does that help us deal with the problem of child abuse. And because of that, I want to warn everybody that today's program is dealing with child abuse, and it's possible that some of the discussion would not be suitable for younger listeners. So please take that into account. Also, be aware that some of the more recent statistics that I can give you in a kind of a way to summarize where we're going today is that in 2006, we know that there were 6 million children in the United States that were referred to authorities because of suspect maltreatment. More than half of these, about 3 million, were deemed worthy of some official response, and about a sixth or a million of them, 900,000 to be exact, were the suspicions were substantiated. In most situations, the parent, alone or with another person, were by far the most commonly responsible individuals for the children's mistreatment or maltreatment. And most importantly, and what we'll get into more today, is that the evidence is increasing that child maltreatment has rather pervasive and long-term physical and mental consequences for children. Which once that has been recognized, it really it is imperative that we begin to do what we can not only to prevent but also to address these long-term consequences. My guests today are two. Dr. Kathy Baldwin Johnson is a family physician. She's also the medical director of Alaska Cares. Alaska Cares is an outpatient clinic in Anchorage that provides sexual abuse and physical abuse evaluations for children from newborn time period to age 18, and we'll ask her to describe that a little bit more for us as well. And our second guest is Josh Arvinson. He's a licensed clinical social worker, and he's the clinic manager of and project director of what's known as the National Child Traumatic Stress Network, and that network's Alaska site is where he is the project director. He's also a clinical manager of the Alaska Child Trauma Project, which is located at the Anchorage Community Health Center in Anchorage. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Nice to have you here. Kathy, before we get into definitions and so forth, tell us a little bit about Alaska Cares, and then I'm going to ask Josh to talk a little bit about what his organization is all about, and then we'll get into the definitions today.
Sure. Alaska Cares is a child advocacy center. It's based on a national model. The first one was actually developed in Huntsville, Alabama, more than 20 years ago. There are now more than, I think, 700 child advocacy centers across the center or across the country. The hallmark of a child advocacy center is that it's multidisciplinary. So all of the different agencies and people who might be involved when there's a concern for child abuse or neglect come together to bring their resources to the child and to the family. So the child comes to one place, the law enforcement, if they're involved, the Office of Children's Services, medical providers, other social workers who can provide support and education for the family, all come together in one facility.
So the reason for the child advocacy centers was to address in a uniform way child maltreatment, or was there some other, motivating factor?
It was for folks to try to work together as a team. And when a child has to tell their story over and over and over again, there's certainly a fair amount of trauma involved in that process for a child. So this way a child can tell their story once. Everybody who needs to hear what they have to say is there to hear what they have to say. they can get this their interview, their forensic interview by somebody who's trained to talk to children about very difficult subjects, have that done. And at that same visit, usually go ahead and have their medical exam done by somebody who's also skilled in evaluating children for possible abuse, and get the process started for getting hooked up with counseling and referrals to other resources in the community that this child and family might need.
How many of the child advocacy centers exist in the state?
We now have, I think, about close to 10 child advocacy centers that are either open or in development in Alaska now.
And birth through or neonatal through 18 years of age, how do people enter the system? What's the most common way that you would become aware of a child that needs to be evaluated?
Referrals might come from law enforcement. So here in Anchorage, the Crimes Against Children Unit of APD or state troopers. Sometimes we see children from outlying areas or sometimes from outlying villages in Alaska. And we also take referrals from medical providers in the community.
Josh, tell us a little bit about your organization, the Community Health Center, and then exactly what you're doing. How do you fit in with the Community Health Center?
We're the Alaska Child Trauma Center. We're housed within Anchorage Community Mental Health Services. And we're the Alaska site for the National Child Traumatic Stress Network. And the National Child Traumatic Stress Network, it's a principal federal effort to raise the standard of care for children who have experienced trauma. And it's headquartered out of Duke and UCLA. And then there's about 10 different centers across the country that do research around evidence-based treatment for child trauma. And then there's about 20 centers across the country, which we're part of, which are community integration centers and adaptation centers and service centers. And so what we do is we're sort of where the rubber hits the road in terms of evidence-based practice for child trauma. We implement evidence-based practices in our communities, and we provide feedback to the developers of evidence-based practices on how to improve those practices in application sort of in the real world. So that's kind of what we do in a nutshell.
So to make sure I understand it, the child advocacy centers are the initial interaction with the child and the family and so forth in some allegation. Then an evaluation takes place, and then you're more into the treatment and evaluating the outcomes of treatment. Is that fair to say?
I think that's very fair to say.
Yes, and we receive referrals from Alaska Cares.
Let me just take this second to remind everybody you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. Our guests today are Kathy Baldwin Johnson and Josh Arvidson, and we're talking about child abuse. If you've got questions, comments, experiences, or would just like to call in and talk to us about an issue related to child abuse, let me give you a couple of ways to do that. Our local number is 550-8433, 550-8433. That and our email address will be here till just before 3 o'clock today. There is a taped rebroadcast at 8 o'clock, and you can always go to KSKA.org and listen to the podcast at any time. Outside of Anchorage, there's a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And email while we're here, line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, all one word, at KSKA.org. So what are we talking about, Kathy, when we talk about child abuse or child maltreatment, which I learned last week is a better term?
Maltreatment, I think, is probably a less loaded feeling word, which is why people use that. And it covers the broader spectrum of things, bad things that can happen to children. So that includes certainly physical abuse. So physically hurting a child. Whether it's breaking bones or causing bruises or burns or shaking a child or, you know, any of the other types of physical abuse. Sexual abuse, which may include both touching and non-touching kinds of offenses. So I think sometimes people have the perception that sexual abuse is just about sexual contact, and the reality is sometimes what happens to children are things like being exploited, being used to create child exploitation images that get passed around online, or forcing a child to view those kinds of images. So again, sexual abuse covers a broader spectrum than people often think of, I think. Neglect is another form of maltreatment, and that's failing to meet a child's basic needs. So whether that's failing to meet their nutritional needs or their educational needs or, you know, keeping them safe, protecting them, neglect is another form of maltreatment. And then there's emotional abuse, so belittling or shaming children, you know, making them feel unloved and uncared for. And then also exposing kids to other, you know, damaging kinds of environment. So, for example, children witnessing domestic violence. It's been shown that that's just about as damaging to children as being physically abused themselves.
What do you mean domestic violence that's in the house as opposed to in the media? I don't want to get too sticky, but I mean that's a whole separate issue. But and I think you're referring to in the home or in this case,
it's watching violence between, for example, parents or caregivers in the home.
Uh-huh. How? Well, which of these is the most common? It seems to me we're. These are hard to define, particularly when you talk about neglect. That kind of, for me, would be somewhat mushy to define and be clear about. Am I being wrong about that, or is it very difficult sometimes to really substantiate that or get everybody to agree on what might be neglect?
You're absolutely right. Neglect is actually the most common type of child maltreatment, but it is also the most challenging to try to figure out whether a child's needs aren't being met because of something intentional or something that's unintentional and something that could be out of the parent's control. For example, trying to sort out whether a child isn't being fed because the parents are making poor choices about their child or the parents just don't have the resources to be able to feed their child. Can be very challenging.
And Josh, how'd you get involved in this, and what are you doing now specifically? Let's flesh that out a little bit more.
Mm-hmm. Well, we joined the National Child Traumatic Stress Network 4 years ago. At that time, Alaska had never had a site within the National Child Traumatic Stress Network, and as Dr. Johnson was and you had talked at the beginning of the program, Alaska has some of the most powerful negative statistics in the country when it comes to child abuse and neglect. And so our community mental health center, along with a lot of other community partners, said we really need to find a way to do the best job we can helping children recover from trauma. And it's a very important issue here in Alaska. So we joined the network about 4 years ago. And what we focused on at our center is working with children in custody, particularly in the foster care system, because the nationwide longitudinal data says that a lot of the children in the foster care system have experienced quite a bit of trauma. They frequently have experienced multiple traumas, and they have a lot of difficulties longitudinally. So our focus has been on working with that group of kids. And similar to what Dr. Johnson was just talking about, what we found in a lot of the national data and research suggests is that children who've been exposed to multiple traumas, they can really have a cumulative effect and that there can be long-term sort of consequences and impacts from trauma. People generally, when you talk about trauma in the media, people generally tend to think of things like earthquakes or hurricanes, and those things certainly can be traumatic. But we have sort of a hidden crisis in the state and across the country of things like child abuse and neglect, which are actually much more common than people think. So that's our focus.
So perhaps a little different in the groups that you're looking at, and you correct me if I'm wrong, you're looking at families that are already within the child's been taken out of the home. Mm-hmm. Kathy and Alaska Cares may see some of those, but you're also seeing patients or kids that are already or still well within the home situation.
Absolutely.
So what are the big risks or the big traumas, let me put it that way, that's where I was really trying to get, that you worry about most, that you see and the evidence suggests is affecting kids long term?
Well, looking at both our center and 50 other centers that have collected longitudinal data, the most common type of trauma that children who show up at trauma centers have experienced is neglect. The second most common is physical abuse, and sexual abuse is the third most common. when you look at the children who show up at trauma centers across the country, and we've been able to track over 10,000 children over a long period of time, what we've discovered is that children who experience what we're now calling complex trauma, which is trauma that occurs in the home, in the caregiving system, and trauma that's usually recurrent or chronic, those children seem to have the most difficulties. So one of our focuses and the focus of the network that we're part of is really finding out how we can help children who experience or multiple exposures to trauma or complex trauma, and really taking a look at how that impacts children across development as well.
You both mentioned that neglect is the most common, and yet we've already kind of agreed that that's kind of a nebulous, hard to explain. Tell me or explain to me or my listeners, our listeners, what do you mean by neglect? Give me some concrete examples. And Kathy, you're welcome to pipe in. I'd like to hear your thoughts on it. I want people to be thinking about what people involved in this issue really consider fairly straightforward childhood neglect. What do we mean?
Well, like Dr. Johnson was saying, neglect can be hard to operationalize. That's a difficult term to think about. What we've seen and centers across the country have seen is that in most severe cases of neglect that we work with and most centers work with involve substance abuse in the caregiving system. About 80% of the cases we work with where there's neglect present, there's serious substance abuse issues in the caregiving system. And that makes sense in terms of a sort of a causal factor. We also look at the basic capacity to provide care for the child. And it can be difficult to operationalize sometime, but most cases that we end up working with when we look at neglect, that's a pretty big sort of causal factor.
So what I'm visualizing with what you've said then is that people who are caught up in drug problems may not physically or sexually abused or maybe even not emotionally, that gets children, but they are neglecting their basic needs to a significant enough amount that it is – it's a problem, not meeting their needs for social interaction, for love, for even food or sleep or a place to live. Is that what you're saying?
And a place to feel secure and safe.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. The thing about neglect is so, as Dr. Johnson was saying, that neglect can be so powerful, and some people wouldn't initially think that neglect could be such a serious issue, is that we're now learning a lot more about how important the attachment relationship between the child and the caregiver is, even in their basic brain development. So a baby, even a newborn baby, is really dependent on their caregiver, not just for food and nurturance, but the interaction between the child and the parent is really critical even for their brain development. So there's more and more evidence suggesting, why it is that things like witnessing domestic violence, for example, like Dr. Johnson was talking about, can have such a powerful impact because it impacts that sense of safety.
Okay, we're going to take a short break, and then I want to come back and flesh out these findings a little bit more and also ask you, Kathy, about what happens in an evaluation at Alaska Cares a little bit more specifically. You're listening to Line 1, your health connection on KSKA. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
Get away and stay in AK at the University of Alaska Southeast in Juneau. Join the UAS Residential Learning Community. Study glacial climate change, marine mammals in their natural habitat, or archaeology on land first inhabited by coastal Alaska natives. Start your life adventure at UAS. Details online at uas.alaska.edu/future. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast.
Welcome back. This is Line 1, your health connection. My guests today are Josh Arvidson and Dr. Kathy Baldwin-Johnson, and our topic is child abuse. If you've got questions or comments about what you hear today, give us a call. 550-8433 is our local number, 550-8433. We have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752, and you can email us at line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at kska.org. All of that should happen between now and just before 3 o'clock. Otherwise, you're listening to a tape rebroadcast, and I'm not going to be here for sure at 8 o'clock when that's going on. So let us know your thoughts or comments at any time during this next hour. Kathy, I failed to follow up on something I wanted to make sure we do. I think people might be very much interested in a little bit of an overview of what happens during an evaluation. You've mentioned how children might end up in Alaska Cares for an evaluation of possible abuse or maltreatment. What happens exactly? Take us through a typical evaluation.
As I said, we take referrals from law enforcement, from the Office of Children's Services, or from medical providers in the community that have a concern about a child. When the child comes to Alaska Cares, they're in the company of a non-offending parent or a non-offending caregiver. We have several family waiting areas. There's an initial, what we call pre-conference, where we get together with the parent or caregiver along with whoever is going to be involved in this evaluation, somebody from OCS, somebody from law enforcement, staff from CARES, and we sit down and talk with the parent or caregiver about the concern with their child and hear what they have to say about what's been going on with this child. That's also a good chance for the medical providers to be able to get some of the child's medical history as well. Then the child has a forensic interview, which, as I mentioned before, is conducted by somebody who's trained to talk to children. And that interview is conducted in a very child-friendly, child-oriented room. And the rest of the team watches the interview from a different room. And then periodically, the interviewer will come out and ask the other team members if there are any other questions that they might have forgotten or information that, you know, that particular member of the team might need that the interviewer hasn't asked yet. For example, maybe there's a more medically oriented symptom kind of question that I need the answer for. And then the child has, if it's indicated, sometimes nothing has happened at all, and the child says, no, nothing mm-hmm. is wrong. Mm-hmm. There's been a misunderstanding of some kind. But oftentimes, then the child undergoes a medical exam, and that's a comprehensive head-to-toe exam of the child. We feel very strongly that it's important that children have their whole bodies respected and evaluated, and we let them know their whole bodies are important in this process. And it's important for us to be able to reassure children that their bodies are okay, that even when bad things happen, children have this amazing capacity to heal and be very normal afterwards. And then after the exam, we sit down again with the caregiver, and we explain about the results of the interview and the exam. And at that point, we make recommendations for the child and family for what kind of safety plan that they need so that nothing happens to this child in the future, so that if there is an offender who needs to be held accountable, then the parent has an idea of what the next steps will be in the investigation and make referrals for counseling or any other community resources the family might need.
It seems like from the statistics I read at the beginning of the program that there's a lot more allegations than substantiation. Is that because of the difficulty in making a substantiation, or because there's a lot more allegations that are really, in our term, false positives? That means we think something's happened when really nothing really did.
There certainly are misunderstandings and some, you know, false allegations, but the vast majority of the time, it has to do with the burden of proof that both child protection mm-hmm. workers and law enforcement agents need in order to substantiate or to bring forward an investigation.
Mm-hmm. And you also mentioned something before the program that surprised me. You also do consultations. So sometimes you may come into a hospital, for example, to give your opinion about situation.
Right. Sometimes there are children that come to one of the area hospitals with an injury, and most commonly I either go over to Providence or to Matsu Regional out in the valley, which is where I live, and so I'll do a consultation.
Josh, before we went to that short break, you were telling us that there's some long-term consequences. So let's tell us a little bit about your research, and then maybe we can get into what do we know about the physical, the objective evidence that we can show that there's a change in the brain, for example, or some other organ.
Yeah, there's been a lot done in probably the last 15, 20 years looking at how trauma and traumatic stress actually impacts the brain. Of course, most of the original research done on trauma was actually done with veterans. And the only diagnosis we have in our diagnostic nosology right now for trauma is post-traumatic stress disorder, which most people will probably be familiar with. But
and the reason it's veterans is because that stress was war.
Right.
And what happens
right.
in those kind of things like the Vietnam War, which I think is where the yeah. all got started.
Yeah, the diagnosis for post-traumatic stress disorder was originally developed by psychiatrists working in the Veterans Administration, mm-hmm. working with combat veterans from Vietnam primarily. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that we've learned about how trauma and stress impact the brain and the body, the physiological system, is that exposure to danger really sets off an alarm system in the brain. And they've actually been able to demonstrate this looking at brain imaging studies. When you look at a brain that's being exposed to an acutely stressful situation, you actually see activity really take off in the limbic system in the back brain. And you see this huge increase in the systems in the brain that regulate things like your heart rate, your blood pressure, respiration. And that makes a lot of sense when you think about it from a basic biological perspective. When somebody's in a dangerous situation, they need to be able to respond. If you think about the classic fight, flight, or freeze response, it really, really requires that the human being be able to respond in some pretty powerful ways. And when someone's exposed to acute stress, the activity actually in the front brain, which does a lot of things that we think about a brain doing, like cognition, problem solving, those sorts of things, that function is actually decreased a little bit. But again, it makes sense. You know, if the grizzly bear comes around the corner, you're not sitting there thinking, you know, about philosophy or, you know, are grizzly bears and brown bears really two distinct species, those sorts of things, right? You have to be able to respond in a powerful way. So one of the really important things that we've learned about how stress impacts individuals is that the stress response is not pathology. It's part of what really enables us to survive as human beings. I think it's a really important perspective mm-hmm. from the perspective of a provider or a family who's helping a child recover, because that stress response really is part of what enables us to survive as human beings and protect ourselves and protect our loved ones. It's totally normal. Mm-hmm. If you're in combat and somebody's shooting at you and you're yawning, you know, that's not how it works, right? You have to have that strong response. And we've known that for a long time, way before we did brain imaging studies, right? How do we train law enforcement, EMTs, soldiers, people who deal with stress all the time? Well, we train them using what? Repetition, those sorts of things, because we know that when a brain is exposed to acute, dangerous stress, that it goes into this sort of basic alarm system response. So one of the things that we found is that one of the sort of myths is that trauma doesn't impact children. A lot of people would say that, especially young children, you know, maybe because they can't remember it or verbalize the experience. But what the more recent research has demonstrated is that children's brains have an alarm system too, just like adult brains do. And when someone's exposed to acute stress, it kicks off this whole physiological response. Well, when this happens over and over and over again in cases of like complex trauma, for example, or child abuse, which frequently is a recurring sort of phenomenon, it can have all sorts of impacts on, you know, the ability to concentrate, ability to do other things. You can get a situation where the physiological system is hyper-aroused or hyper-vigilant to danger in the environment that can have real implications for learning and school and all those sorts of things. So.
I want to come back to that, because to me that's the critical thing. It's one thing to say we can see that there's a stress reaction, which we all have mm-hmm. just said is normal, but we got to get to the point where that causes some long-term problems, and we need to ferret that out. At least I need to in my mind a little bit. But we do have a caller, and I want to go ahead and take Joan first. Joan, you're on line one.
Yes, hi. I would like some comment on prevention of neglect, since your presenters or your speakers are talking about knowing that alcohol and other drugs are a big piece of the abuse. What kind of work is being done in the community to reduce abusive drinking?
Okay. Big question. What's being done on prevention?
A lot of the prevention efforts, I think, are geared towards education of parents. There certainly are substance abuse treatment programs in the community, and when we see children at Alaska Cares or at other child advocacy centers. If substance abuse is something that's identified, one of the referrals that we'll make for the parent or caregiver who's struggling with substance abuse is referral to a treatment center.
Is there any work done knowing that it is almost a precursor? In other words, really going upriver and trying to abuse and neglect instead of waiting until the child is abused and then caregiver is referred to treatment. Is there anything being done at a larger scale at reducing abusive drinking in the city?
Joan, your point. Let me address this from a point of view of someone who's been involved with nonprofits and education and public health for a long time. And the issue is, education sounds like the right way to go, and is often where we're spending a lot of effort. But you know, I have to say, my experience in this area is it's advocacy and regulation that leads to change. We wouldn't have all our kids in seatbelts if there wasn't a law. I'm a big believer in that. We wouldn't be having the success with cigarette smoking if we weren't out there advocating and setting up regulations. So where I see your point is you want to get in there and prevent very early and quickly, and that's a difficult one to do. Am I making sense, or am I missing your point?
You're right on. We've done it in tobacco.
Right.
And we can do it in alcohol. There just needs to be, like the presenters are saying, it is a contributing factor in their neglect cases.
Yeah, we need to be constantly pushing on the awareness issue, both at the legislative level as well as our little level of just talking to people who listen to KSKA.
Exactly, and thank you.
You bet, Joan. Have a good day. All right, Josh, where were we? I was getting interested in this stress response. We've actually talked about the stress response in the 10 years or so. I've been doing this with a couple of real experts in the area. I'm well aware of that. I'm a little less understanding of how that causes some chronic disability, particularly psychiatric disability in kids. So take us past the initial stress response and how that may change things. And why is it perhaps more important even in children or infants than it might be in an adult?
Yeah. A couple things that we've been learning about how the stress response impacts children longitudinally. One of the things is that when someone's exposed to acute stress and this alarm system goes off, I mean, one of the ways to think about PTSD, for example, is if you think about the alarm system as like a fire alarm, and you know, like in school buildings where they have the little red box with the white handle, and you pull the white handle, it turns off the fire alarm. If you think about the alarm system in the brain almost that way, one of the theories behind post-traumatic stress disorder is that handle for that alarm system has been pulled so hard or been pulled so many times that all it takes is just a little whoosh, and it goes off.
Now, if you stick your hand in a light socket enough times, the next time you get near the light socket, you're not going to stick your hand in the light socket. You already know what's coming.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah. And you would actually see a physiological response. You'd actually see blood pressure go up as you got closer.
Yeah.
So the brain learns really, really well. kids' brains learn even better than adult brains. So what happens is that when you have an acute exposure to acute stress, the brain starts to develop what we call a state of hyperarousal. And what that means is that the physiological system is attuned to perceive danger in the environment. We also see something called hypervigilance, which is a constant sort of search for potential danger in the environment. Well, this has implications, you know, across the spectrum, because one of the things that a couple researchers in our network have taken a look at is kids who've been exposed to really high levels of traumatic experiences, particularly child abuse, and they've actually studied them in the classroom. And what they found is that these children experienced really high levels of abuse actually in the classroom. We're sort of in a hypervigilant or hyperaroused state, and their alarm system was pretty easily triggered. For example, a colleague of mine worked with a young man who had been exposed to years and years and years of domestic violence. And in working with him when he was in a classroom, he was about 14 years old, was working with him when he was in the classroom, what happened is when the classroom would get noisy, you could literally sort of, if you watched him really closely, you could sort of see him sort of go into a fight, flight, freeze sort of response. And he would actually kind of act out and get kicked out of the classroom, and his teacher would tell him to go down to the principal's office. Well, he didn't go down to the principal's office. He'd go into the bathroom. And he'd go into the bathroom, and he'd sit down, and he'd put his head up against the wall of the stall. And he said, you know, putting my head up against, and I could just feel the cold pressing through my forehead, and I could feel myself starting to calm down. I could feel my heart rate starting to go down. I could feel okay again. And then he'd go back to his classroom. That's sort of a classic example of how, you know, exposure to acute stress would really make, would really create a situation in which the individual could be triggered and have a lot, in lots of situations, have a lot of difficulty in an academic environment, for example. So I don't know if that kind of addresses your question.
So it could be confused for an attentional problem or a learning mm-hmm. problem or a forgetful problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we see a lot of children who get referred to trauma centers are diagnosed with ADHD, and some may actually have that, but we also see a lot of children who maybe don't really have ADHD, but when they're triggered by something in their environment, become hyperactive or you start to act out in a way. And again, thinking about the basic stress response, we look at how kids adapt to their environment. That young man I talked about, for example, he had developed a behavior adaptation that was meeting his, you know, his basic needs to get out of the classroom and get into a quiet place. So
I've used the example enough on this program that for me, it's repetitive, but perhaps there's listeners that it's not, is that what we're learning about the nervous system is that we set up maybe neural circuits are not the same way, but I've used the example, when you learn to ride a bike as a kid, that's the mm-hmm. rest of your life. You're going to know how to ride a bike. It doesn't take long to get good at it again, even at my age. Maybe our balance is not so good, but I still know how to ride a bike. So what you're saying, or what I'm hearing you say, and what I'm conceptualizing simplicity, if we're exposed to these exposures that are traumatic to us, we set up an automatic cycle that gets us right back to that very quickly. And it may even be things that have nothing to do with it. It just... It close enough approximates it, it sets up this behavior that's happened. And then I think of as a consequence is we have to learn as humans to cope with that. Are we going to adapt to it? What are we going to do to survive this thing? We're not just like mouse that we just every once in a while we zap them to see how they respond. We're thinking out there about how we're going to respond. And so that leads to these more chronic kinds of problems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we see sort of two responses to triggers around chronic stress. One is that the sort of classic thing is an associative trigger. An example for that would be, you know, for example, somebody who's in a combat situation and attacked while driving a Humvee, for example, and then has difficulty driving in traffic 2 years later, and actually has sort of a panic attack when they're in traffic because that situation directly sort of reminds them. But what we found too is what you're talking about, which is a more general adaptation as well that can happen to stress. And this is particularly critical with children because their brains are developing. So they're developing basic ways of interpreting information from the world. And so we can see general adaptations where, not just a specific reminder, you know, that boy, for example, in that loud classroom, mm-hmm. just that was enough to really sort of kick him into a physiological stress response.
I'm going to go ahead and take another break here. We have another caller coming in. There's another number of comments and questions come to my mind about this. But before we do that, I want to remind our listeners you're listening to Line 1, your health connection on KSKA. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
KSKA is listener-supported radio. Hello, I'm Steve Heimel, host of Talk of Alaska. And we're inviting you to call right now, 550-8484. And pledge your financial support to keep local and statewide news and information programs going strong on FM 91.1. Toll free, the number's 800-478-5256, or you can pledge online, kska.org. 91.1 FM is where to tune for local, statewide, and national news and information. Each Monday, you tune into your health with KSKA's locally produced program, Line 1, Your Health Connection, with Dr. Thad Woodard. The call-in invites you to talk to experts in the health field on issues that affect your health and your family's well-being. Dr. Woodard keeps you connected with your community and offers insight and information on issues that matter to you. Call in with your pledge of support, 550-8484 or 800-478-5256. Online, kska.org. KSKA, the Alaska Public Radio Network, NPR, and the BBC all work together to provide the best news and information public service on radio today. You rely on the Alaska Public Radio Network, and KSKA relies on you and your financial support to keep this public service healthy and vital. In Anchorage, call 550-8484, toll-free 800-478-5256, or online, kska.org. Thanks for listening, and thank you for supporting KSKA Anchorage.
This is Line 1, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Witter. Today's guest is Dr. Kathy Baldwin-Johnson and Josh Arvidson, and we're talking about child abuse. If you want to make any comments or give us some experiences, perhaps, 550-8433 is our local number. We have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And email us directly at lineone@kska.org. I'd like to take, we have two callers. I'd like to take Tina and see what she's got to comment on. Tina, you're on line one.
Hi. I was wondering about, because I was a product of a dysfunctional family and did have sexual abuse going on when I was a child. And now I'm 55, and I've come to believe that I have more of the symptoms of PTSD than depression, even though I'd been, taking Zoloft for depression. And but I'm not, like sad and blue and stuff, but I do, I'm hypervigilant, and I have startle, a very, very strong startle response. And it seems to me that those are more of my symptoms. And is it possible to carry that for so long?
Good question. Wonderful question. I got a parallel one, but I'll ask that after we address this one. So can we keep the changes that happen maybe very, very early in life for the rest of our life even?
Absolutely, because there is some evidence that exposure to these kinds of stresses, especially chronic stressors, actually changes the hardwiring of the brain. It changes the structure of mm-hmm. the brain. And that makes it really challenging then once that kind of hardwiring change takes place at vulnerable times during childhood or adolescence as to know, what is going to be the best way to treat that person once they become an adult.
So and when you say hardwiring, or the structure of the brain, I'm back to this neural circuits. It's not that there's a dramatic change in what the brain looks like. It's just that things are there in those people that are a little bit different in the when we look at them under MRIs or whatever than they would be in somebody else.
The changes can actually be quite dramatic.
Ah, okay.
Because they've actually done brain scans on children that have been diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder as a result of sexual abuse and found that their brain volumes are smaller mm-hmm. than children who have not been sexually mm-hmm. abused. So that's pretty profound.
Which may be a result of this stress phenomenon that's chronic, and perhaps adrenaline and hormones that are all induced by this can have some effect on tissue development. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, there can actually
that's true.
There can actually be structural changes. One of the things that similar research has shown is that the amygdala, for example, which is involved in emotional regulation, mm-hmm. can be impacted by chronic stress, and actually mm-hmm. is 17% smaller in a population that is exposed to six or more traumatic experiences in childhood. You also see marked right hemisphere lateralization mm-hmm. When you have cases of chronic exposure trauma. So it actually can have structural impacts. The other positive part of it, though, is that the brain, we're understanding more and more that the brain is much more dynamic and changing throughout the lifespan.
Right.
And that's the positive part of it as well.
Yeah. So we may learn some coping. We're continuing to grow new nerve cells. I was trained. That didn't happen. That's clearly happening now. We know. And so there's this plasticity term that's mm-hmm. talked about is how if one part of the brain may be injured, then the other parts of the brain may take over function. So all that, it doesn't mean that there's a bad life sentence or anything going on, but there are clearly some changes that are lifelong. Potentially.
Trauma really has a lifelong impact. Most people who are exposed to severe trauma lead very productive and happy lives. That's an important thing to remember, too, because we are so adaptable.
Tina, did that help you?
Well, you know, it did. My coping mechanism has always been food, especially carbohydrates.
Ooh, mine too. Pizza.
Yeah, and, I do get told a lot that that's, like, the wrong way to cope, and I take insult with that because, you know, we survive the best we can. And I was just wondering, what is the best type of treatment? Is it psychotherapy? Is it drug-related? Or just dealing with it? I just don't know quite what to do because it's so stressful still.
Great question.
It's probably a combination, figuring out what are the things that the strengths and assets that you have that you can work on to develop, and working with a therapist who's trained in dealing with the aftermath of severe stress as a child. And sometimes medication can be helpful, because if the problem with the wiring is results in your neurotransmitters not being in the right balance for you, then I think medication can be really helpful.
What has surprised me is that it's always bothered me that why do we do psychotherapy when the problem is we're beginning to realize is a hardwiring problem? But more and more evidence is showing that psychotherapy does cause its own hardwiring, and so it does help, and it does change the brain also, so that psychotherapy has some long-term benefits as well. Gets me out of the medication for everything mode anyway, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, and there's been some research taking a look at that showing that for post-traumatic stress disorder, for example, medications can be effective. Psychotherapy can be very effective. And like Dr. Johnson was saying, it's really, for most people, it's sort of a process of individualizing and figuring out what's going to work.
I want to take another caller, but before I do, there was another issue that Tina had brought up that I thought was something that we need to talk about. If you're really thinking about this from a research standpoint, how do you know Tina wasn't innately genetically predisposed to be the way she thinks she is now? How do you separate nature and nurture, which is a huge issue and research, and you have to address that issue if you're really going to get to the roots of the problems. Are we able to do that? How do we do it?
I think that the current research indicates that there's probably a combination in terms of how people respond to stress, because it's very clear that you can take two different children, expose them to very similar types of stress, and one child will be much more resilient than the other child, and we really don't understand that part.
Mm-hmm.
What is really clear, however, is that that exposure to all of these different kinds of stressors that children can have, whether it's physical abuse, sexual abuse, neglect, emotional abuse, exposure to domestic violence, exposure to a household where there's mental illness or suicide in the family, where there's exposure to criminal behavior and violence in the family, all of those things have lifelong repercussions. And the more of those things that children experience, the more likely they are to have adverse effects as adults. And some of that's probably because of these changes in the brain. People do figure out coping skills.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she referred to carbohydrates as her coping skill.
Right.
Well, people do select things that make them feel better. Carbohydrates are one of them. For some people, it's alcohol. For some people, it's smoking cigarettes. For some people, it's methamphetamine.
So it's exercise.
or not exercising.
Okay.
There's actually a link. There's this huge study. It's called the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study. And they actually found a link between bad things happening to children and the likelihood of being a couch potato as an adult.
Yeah.
So it's pretty incredible.
Leon, you're on line one.
Well, thank you, and thanks for your guest today. I was just wanting to respond to the types of treatment available, and I think Anchorage is a community in particular that has a large number of therapists who have been trained in trauma, and in a combination with perhaps a psychiatrist and a therapist, the meds in that overview, as well as a therapy that has some protocols to deal with the physiological effects. Just one example is if you go to the Empire State Building and stand on top and look over, you get that funny feeling in your stomach. If you're back on the street and walking and still having it, that's, to me, post-traumatic stress, and
mm-hmm.
that's the body.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what we're taught is most of our emotions come from the body. So I think work with post-traumatic stress really needs to include an appreciation for the startle reflex, most of these persons have, and I appreciate the program today.
All right. Yeah, thanks for your comments. All right, let's go ahead. We have one more caller. Sean, you're on line one.
Hi. I wanted to thank you. And the one question I had, a lot of the symptoms of the post-traumatic stress disorder in children, it sounded like what I knew about attachment disorder and reactive attachment disorder, and I wanted to know if those are very similar.
All right. Let's define our terms to start with. Somebody tell me what attachment disorder is, and then answer his question.
I'll go to the second part first because that's the easier part. Looking at traumatic stress and comorbidity, we've been able to do that through a study we're participating with Duke. And
comorbidity is
the existence of one or more sort of problems at a time.
Okay.
And one of the things that we found is that for children who've been exposed to traumatic stress, the likelihood of being diagnosed with reactive attachment disorder, for example, goes up exponentially. And the diagnosis actually of reactive attachment disorder, according to the DSM, is unique in that unlike most DSM diagnoses, which don't talk a lot about causality or the diagnosis for depression describes depression, but it doesn't really talk much about how depression happens. Reactive attachment disorder is unique in that the American Psychiatric Association has said that reactive attachment disorder is usually associated with pretty traumatic experiences in early childhood. So separating out reactive attachment disorder and post-traumatic stress can be actually very, very tricky. One of the things that we look at is that if you take out the whole idea of reactive attachment disorder, which is a very specific diagnosis for a very specific set of symptoms, when we look at kids who've been exposed to traumatic stress, we frequently see that they have difficulties in attachment relationships. And that's one of the most critical factors in terms of treatment at our center and most centers who work with kids who've been experienced trauma. We work a lot with the caregivers because it's really in that attachment relationship, that relationship to the caregiver, that serves as the primary protective factor. There's actually been some longitudinal research done on this. The Annie Casey Foundation did some studies on children who are alumni of the foster care system. And the single most important and critical factor for children who did well, who had been in foster care, was that they could identify that they had had a meaningful relationship with an adult who really connected to them and believed in them. So the issue of attachment trauma is really, really complex. But what we know is that the biggest protective factor for children who experience trauma is that attachment relationship to their caregivers. It's the biggest factor in helping kids recover.
Comment, Sean?
That makes it a lot clearer. Thank you.
Thank you. I remember one time looking at the evidence or the information on kids with chronic disease. Let's just say, chronic neurologic disease, so someone who's had a significant brain injury early in life and whatever. The single most important variable in outcome was how well the caregiver understood what was going on. Not how good the therapist was, not how good the medication was, not how good the physician was, not how good anything is. It's who's the person that's dealing with that child every day, day in and day out, and understands how to think for themselves and be creative when it needs to be and continue to focus on that. So why would – go ahead.
I was just going to say that the centers that we have in our network that are down in the Gulf that have been responding to the hurricanes, they've done some research looking at what are the protective factors for children who've been displaced by Hurricane Katrina, for example. And the number one predictor of positive outcome for children who've been displaced by the hurricane wasn't, how quickly they accessed treatment. It wasn't a lot of things that people would expect. The number one predictor was how long it took to get the child back into school, which is a really powerful sort of indicator of how that caregiving system is so critical. Kids who were able to get back enrolled in school and participate in school did considerably better.
See, I would generalize that a little bit more, and you guys tell me if I'm wrong. If you think about the brain as setting up neural circuits, and you've started a circuit that's not very good, the quicker you do something to get away from that cycle, the better. So early recognition, early treatment, early changing the way you're thinking, or the way you're avoiding things. So early is better. So what I heard you say is we've got to get them back into school, and that's getting them back into the normal situation. And so it really gets back into awareness by everybody of if there's something really going on, the earlier, the quicker, the faster we can address those issues, which is true about everything in medicine now that you think about it.
Absolutely.
But the better we have a chance of having a positive outcome. Does that make sense?
I think that's absolutely true. You know, I think that ability, you know, this whole attachment and bonding thing that starts with a brand new baby, that has an influence that forming relationships is just critical for our health and well-being, I think, through the rest of our lives. So the more support that we can give, either as healthcare providers to parents or family members to people with children or other community members who see parents struggling, the more help and support we can give to help parents be better parents, the better off I think children will be.
We really only have a couple of minutes left. It's been very fast. And so what I want to do now is what's the lessons? What do we want to hear if people hear and come take away from this situation what they or this podcast? What do we want them to remember?
I think the most critical thing is to remember that what happens to children really can have a lifelong impact on their health and well-being, impacts that last, you know, well into adulthood. And so it's very important as a community and as individuals that we take a stand and that we do everything we can to intervene in the cycle of child maltreatment.
And as soon as possible.
As early as possible. Okay. And prevention, of course, is always better
good point. Josh?
I was just thinking in terms of a community response. Because we know that, you know, being safe in school and having good positive relationships with adults and those things are such critical protective factors. We're learning that it really the whole community has a role to play in helping children who've been exposed to trauma recover. That what you do in your classroom, you know, what you do through, you know, Big Brothers Big Sisters or Boys and Girls Club or whatever it is, that those interactions are really critical in helping children recover. And so that the whole community trauma intervention isn't some sort of thing that just happens like in a therapist's office, for example. It's really about the family and the community helping children recover.
Okay. Kathy Baldwin-Johnson is one of our guests today. She is the medical director of Alaska Cares, which is a clinic that does evaluations of suspicious or suggested sexual or physical abuse. And Josh Arvidson is the clinical manager and project director of the National Child Traumatic Stress Network at the Alaska site, and also manage the Alaska Child Traumatic Project at the Anchorage Community Health Center. I want to say thanks to both of them for being here today. Next week we'll be back, and we're going to be talking about the colon and the rectum, particularly surgery of that, particularly colorectal cancer, with Dr. Mark Kemen. So tune into your health and learn more next Monday, April 13th at 2 p.m., repeating the same evening at 8 p.m. on FM 91.1. For KSKA and for Line 1, this is Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
This has been Line 1, your health connection. If you have questions or comments concerning this program, write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508, or email us at line1@kska.org. Additional information on today's show topic, including relevant website links, will be posted along with audio of today's program on our website at kska.org/line1. CD copies of this program can be purchased by calling 550-8400 during regular business hours. This is KSKA, Anchorage.